Our next guest on the program is the author of several books, Gunslinger, all about Brett Favre, the bad guys won. I can't even mention that team. I can. 86 minutes. The Rocket Who Fell to Earth, and many, many more, including a brand new book that hits the bookshelves and the interwebs next week, September 11th, entitled Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. Jeff Perlman joins us this afternoon. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a book that concerns the Red Sox in the 86 Mets. I had to say it for you.
Oh, yeah, I had to say that, didn't you? Knew it would happen. This book, talk about a labor of love. As I understand it, you put a lot of time and effort into this book that goes all the way back to a research paper in high school.
Yeah, well, I grew up, I'm a child of the 80s, and I love the USFL, like love, love, love. And when I was a Mayo Pack High School, Mayo Pack, New York, I was a senior, AP English. My teacher, Mr. Height, gave us we had to write a 20-page paper for our final project, which seemed like a ton for a 18-year-old kid. And I said I wanted to do the downfall of the United States Football League. And the guy's like, really? Yeah, I just think it's going to be really good. And he's like, the kid next to you is doing, like, the history of Lake Mayo Pack. And someone else is doing, like, Ronald Reagan versus Jimmy Carter, an analysis of presidencies. And you're doing the USFL. But he let me do it, and I ended up handing in 40 pages to, I'm sure, his not-delight about the downfall of the USFL, because I just love that league so ridiculously much. And I got a B+.
That's it, a B+. Well, from what we're hearing, the book is going to get much better grade than that. The USFL, I'm a little bit older than you, but, man, that was such a fun league, and so much talent gathered in that league, and so many guys who went on to have success in the NFL. What was it about that league that drew you to them in the day?
I mean, it's kind of like when you're a kid, what is it that draws you to singers or TV shows or whatever? For me, the USFL was the colors, the uniforms, the names, the bandits, the gold, the outlaws, the maulers. It was different. It was a spring league instead of a fall. They had different rules. They had the coach's challenge. They had instant replay. They had, one foot in. There was a catch. They had kicking off a tee. And mostly, I think it's just the audacity of it all. Like, they started just picking off NFL players left and right. They started drafting and signing players the NFL desperately wanted. They got Herschel Walker. Then they signed the next two Heisman Trophy winners, Mike Rozier and Doug Flutie. It was just an audacious sort of, groundbreaking idea to football that I just loved.
Well, one of those owners, of course, the man who sits in the White House these days, and number 45, some of the things he does today are some of the same things he did. You write that Trump was very, he was very Trumpy as an owner in the USFL.
Well, he ruined the league. That's not a political statement. He actually ruined the league. And you can go back. First season, 1983, he did not own the New Jersey Generals. The second season, he bought the Generals. And in the lead up to buying the team, all he did was praise the USFL, how great the league is. I love it. I'm excited to be here. He's approved as an owner. All the papers are signed. Immediately, we need to move to fall. Fall is where the action is. We need to move to fall. And, in hindsight, it turns out, and this has been well documented, he wanted an NFL franchise. That's it. He didn't care about the USFL. He never cared about the USFL. He saw the USFL as a ticket to getting in the NFL, and even had a meeting. While he was a USFL owner, he arranged a meeting with Pete Rozelle, the NFL commissioner, at the Pierre Hotel in New York City, where he said to him, I don't care about the USFL. I've never really cared about it. I'll do what you guys need for me to get an NFL franchise. And he really had the idea, because the Jets had just moved to New Jersey, to have a team in Manhattan. And he thought he could use the USFL as leverage. And Pete Rozelle, who saw through him immediately and always had, said very bluntly, as long as I am involved with the NFL, as long as my family is involved with the NFL, you will never have a team. And Trump, one of his qualities, I guess, he doesn't really take no for an answer. And he continued to push the USFL to move to fall, fight the NFL, with the hopes that ultimately they would force the NFL into merging. And as many people know, they sued the NFL, and they won $1. And that was the death of the USFL.
Do you think that it's coincidence that all these years later, Trump has made it a key part of his agenda to attack the NFL? Obviously, some of that is to appeal to the base, but how much of that do you think goes back to his inability to get a franchise?
A ton of it. He was rejected by the NFL countless times, time after time after time. They showed no interest in him. Pete Rozelle was very true to his word. The NFL was not interested in him. And one thing that's really kind of fascinating is when Donald Trump started talking about kneeling and NFL players and kneeling and how horrible it is, guys who covered the USFL started bringing up the point that during USFL games, Trump would routinely be sitting down conducting business during the national anthem, that he would not be standing when players are standing. So it all dates back to this feud he's had with the NFL for years and really the feeling of rejection he's had from the league that never showed any interest in him. So it's not a political statement. This is not about left or right, Democrat or Republican. I can just tell you him, what he did to the USFL as a USFL fan was really crushing.
And even before that meeting and the plan to go head-to-head in the fall, he had blown up the salary structure of the league, too, and everybody had agreed early on that they were all going to be on the same page when it came to keeping the salary somewhat reasonable.
I mean, he wasn't the first. He did not deserve, you know, specific blame for that. There are a lot, you know, the Michigan Panthers, 1983, make the USFL title game. The team was struggling, and then the owner, Alfred Taubman, went out and got three former Pittsburgh Steeler offensive linemen and blew up the bank to do it. There was a lot of the Pittsburgh Maulers, you know, signed Mike Rozier out of Nebraska, gave him $1 million at a time when that was not a common thing. Teams got crazy, and Trump definitely sort of took it to the next level where he started signing any. He was going after every. You name an NFL star at that time, he was pretty much going after me. Try getting Warren Moon out of Canada. Try getting Randy White from the Cowboys, Mark Asno from the Jets, Lawrence Teller from the Giants. He almost had an agreement with Don Shula to leave the Dolphins and coach the Generals. He was throwing around money. Again, he wanted a team that was NFL caliber and that the NFL would look at and say, whoa, we need to add this to our sort of profile. Had nothing to do with winning a USFL championship. I don't even think he knew the specifics of that.
And when he signed Doug Flutie, only Trump would do this, he asked for the other owners to chip in and help pay the salary.
And he literally, it's so funny because I was researching that while Trump was talking about building the wall and how Mexico would pay for it. It was almost simultaneous. And they already had Brian Sipe, the 1980 NFL MVP, as their quarterback. So they didn't need a quarterback. But Doug Flutie was big and shiny and bright. So Trump signed him to the biggest contract in pro football history. Doug Flutie, you know, preposterous. And he tells his cohorts at the Generals, he says, I'm going to sign him, but the other owners are going to pay the contract. And he actually wrote a letter that I have to the commissioner at the time, Harry Usher, saying, I've done the USFL an amazing service by bringing in Doug Flutie. You can already see the impact. And I expect all the other owners to contribute to his salary. And the number of owners who contribute to Doug Flutie's salary, not coincidentally, equals the number of Mexican government officials who have put any money into the wall.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. We're talking with Jeff Perlman. His new book comes out next week, Football for a Buck. You can pre-order it. The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. I don't know if you had a favorite team. For me, it was that Houston team and the run-and-shoot offense. How about for you?
It's kind of funny, actually. I was a Generals fan because I grew up in New York. I will say, though, that the Houston Gamblers were probably, if not a close second, in the top three. Number one, they had great uniforms. Number two, Jim Kelly was a quarterback. And I remember 1984, 44 touchdown passes. And the cool thing the Gamblers did is they brought in all these undersized receivers from small colleges, and most of them were running backs in college. So if you remember, Ricky Sanders, who wound up with the Redskins, the Houston Gambler receiver. Gerald McNeil, who ended up with the Browns. Clarence Rodan, who ended up with the Redskins. They were all former, Richard Johnson ended up with the Detroit Lions. They're all like running backs or mediocre small college receivers who all ran 4.2 or 4.3 40s, and they got Mouse Davis from Portland State to be the offensive coordinator. He was the brainchild of the run and shoot, and all of a sudden Houston is putting out four wide receivers, five wide receivers. They signed a tight end because Jack Pardee, the head coach, wanted one, and 3 days later he cut him because he realized there was no need for a tight end in this offense. They just blew up football. It was so exciting.
But Jim Kelly didn't really like that offense when it first started out, right?
No, because he came out of Miami as a drop back and, you know, big arm, just throw it. And they signed him, and they wanted you to roll out, quick hits, and his quick reads, and you're always going to have guys going to be darting all over the field across the middle. He wasn't used to that. He was used to a tight end to a button hook, one guy across the middle, one guy go deep. And he was really resistant to the offense. And then what Jerry Argovitz, the owner of the team, did, he traded for Todd Dillon. L.A. had the rights to Todd Dillon. He was a former Long Beach State quarterback. And Todd Dillon ran that sort of offense in college. And Dylan comes in, and he's practicing, and he looks great. And Jim Kelly meets with Jerry Argovitz one day, and he says, I can't believe you effing brought this guy in. I'm the quarterback. And Argovitz is like, well, let me see you play like it, because you stink. And we will sit you. I don't care how much we're paying you. And he said, you know, from that moment on, Jim Kelly was Jim Kelly and became one of the great quarterbacks in pro football history.
You interviewed some 400 people associated with the USFL. Was there a favorite of all the conversations and all the people you tracked down?
I mean, I loved, as far as big names go, I really loved Steve Young. So Steve Young was a quarterback with the LA Express, and he famously or infamously was signed a $40 million contract, which wasn't really. It was an annuity deal, not altogether unlike what Walter Payton signed with the Bears earlier. But he became known as the $40 million man, the face of greed in pro sports. And he literally was a guy driving like a 19-year-old Oldsmobile with rips in his pants before it was trendy to have rips in his pants. And he's just this guy. And he told me, you know, he's with the Express, and they basically, it started out great, and then they lost all their money, and they had no money to pay players. And the grass became overgrown, and they stopped serving steak and vegetables to the players. And one day they're driving to a game, and the bus driver just pulls the bus over, and he says, I'm not moving another inch until someone on this bus pays me. And they owed him $500. They're trying to pass a hat around the bus, just trying to get to the damn football game. And the trainer ended up like having to go cash a check to pay the owner to pay the bus driver. So it was like, it was just a crazy, crazy sort of thing. And he was great. He was really great.
So two new leagues poised to try and begin to, in some way, compete with the NFL in the next couple of years. What are the lessons from the USFL that future leagues might be wise to learn?
Don't go crazy on spending. Don't take the NFL on directly. I feel like a team could do really well by working with the NFL, by developing players, where the sort of idea is, catch the rising stars, and that it's a great thing if the quarterback for whatever, the Orlando team, winds up in a year being, you know, Dak Prescott's backup with the Cowboys. I feel like that's a way to do it. You cannot take on the NFL directly and expect to win. It's just not realistic. And the NFL is a million times bigger now than it was in the early 80s, so now it would be preposterous.
Jeff, while we have you here, I wanted to also bring up a wonderful piece you did with our basketball coach here at the University of Maine, Richard Barron, for The Athletic, and telling story of his remarkable comeback from an illness that plagued and confused all kinds of medical experts.
Oh, thank you so much. So that was, I went to the University of Delaware. I'm a Blue Hen, and I always have kind of paid attention to Maine sports over the years just because it's just been our conference. And he was this remarkable story and a really impressive and courageous guy. So sometimes you write articles and it's just an honor to do them. And it may not be the best thing you've ever written as far as, you know, dazzling word choice or blah, 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 but you just feel better about yourself that you've told someone's story. And that, I mean, that's a classic example of it.
No doubt about that. Can I mention this pre-order opportunity that the people have for the book and what they could possibly win?
Yes. I mean, you know, if you order the book and you email me, and you can see this all on Twitter on my website, I'm giving away a ton of USFL t-shirts, stickers, you know, even hats, you know, just trying to, because the thing is, the USFL, it's not like most of the books I've written. It was, first of all, it was a pure labor of love. Second of all, it's not like Brett Favre that comes with an automatic audience or Walter Payton or, you know, Bears fans. This is a 30-year-old league. A lot of people don't remember it. A lot of people don't share the passion that I have for it, but it's an amazing story. So basically, I'm going all out to push this thing because I just believe in this book and this story more than any other thing I've written.
The book is Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. It's available on September 11th, but you can pre-order right now. Follow Jeff online as well, at Jeff Perlman. Go to the website, and you're going to enjoy this fantastic book on the U.S. Football League. Jeff, I've been a fan of your work for a long, long time. Thanks so much for making time for us here on the show.
Oh, thank you. I'm really honored. Thank you.